You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 12, good afternoon to you. You at the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. We're coming to you today live from NASREC, the site of the ANC's policy conference. You can join our conversations about the party and its policies. Tweet me at Stephen Curtis or SMS me 31702 or 31567. We'll investigate the damage caused by fake pastors in the next 40 minutes, get the latest on the Qatar dispute, and find out about testosterone and sport. But we start, of course, here at the ANC's policy conference in NASREC, where commissions have been reporting back on the decisions taken. In the next hour or so, President Jacob Zuma is due to give the closing address to this gathering. Last night, the strategy and tactics chair of the ANC, Joel Netshetenze, said 9 of the 11 commissions at this conference has resolved that the phrase white monopoly capital should not be used to characterize the economy. At the same time, the Social Transformation Commission chair, Lindiwe Sisulu, has been reporting back. And about an hour ago now, Zuma himself crossed the security fence, dividing delegates from the media. He made a few brief comments.
Thank you very much. I think that you guys are doing a very good job to inform the country and the world that the ANC is meeting. As always, when it meets, it discusses very serious issues. And I'm sure you have heard, and we are reporting wonderfully. We are very happy indeed. I think the quality of the debate is very high, higher than other times. I'm also happy because we met for a week. This is what we need so that we can deal with the issues. And I think we have time, we're not rushing. And people were able to discuss every issue that was on the table. And as you have seen, the ANC is always vibrant. You know? Thank you very much.
Would you say the ANC would be here united?
ANC has always been united. You guys don't understand the contradictions. They are healthy and constructive contradictions. That's what is in the ANC, not dangerous one. Happy one.
President Jacob Zuma there, speaking very briefly to the media, just crossing that security fence for a few moments today. EWN's Clement Manyatelo was with him. He's in our broadcast van with me now. Clement, afternoon to you. How'd the president look?
Look, he looked very excited. He went from every single media studio, ANN 7, ENCA, SABC, greeting everyone and telling them they're doing an incredible job. Obviously, he wouldn't have left without some journalists asking if he thinks this conference is going to come out united. And he says the ANC has always been united, which is somehow different from the speech and the narrative he was taking on Friday when he spoke about the need for unity in the organization. So he says the ANC will be united. He was asked about white monopoly capital. He says it's an interesting debate that must continue to be spoken about.
And the security around him? I mean, he was in the media space.
Yeah, he was in the media space, and as expected, of course, he was surrounded by heavy security. He was initially supposed to come into the media center, but for some reason, that didn't take place anymore. But yeah, strong security presence around him, but he was willing to take a question or two from journalists, which is very highly unlikely, Stephen, you would know.
EWN's Clement Manyatelo, thank you very much indeed. Well, he was with President Jacob Zuma earlier today. We are expecting the president to make the closing address here at NASREC at some point this afternoon. Well, the Social Transformation Commission is still reporting back in the media center. It's about 50 meters behind me. Its chair is Lindiwe Sisulu, and we've just managed to drag her out of the media center. EWN's Masa Kakana. Masa, thanks to good afternoon to you. What are the main points of the decisions from this commission so far?
Good afternoon, Stephen. Some interesting stuff. Obviously, racism at the top of the agenda, saying that there's a concern that there seems to be racial tensions on the rise. She also spoke about the hate crimes bill being fast-tracked, but says there are no time frames at this given point. And then speaking of the sentencing, the kind of sentencing that they would be looking for these crimes, she said they didn't set a benchmark, but they did set a benchmark for crimes against women and children. They also spoke about public land and state land now having to, they propose that it all should be given to the Department of Human Settlements. And she says that land will therefore then afterwards be used to accommodate students, especially if it's inner city land. They spoke about physical education in school should now be compulsory, and the fast tracking of offensive names. So Of course, we can expect more street name changes in the future. They also spoke about, I know in the show later on, you will be speaking about fake pastors. They spoke about the abuse of religion. We had Budimana Mela talking about how we've seen the rise of these fake pastors, talking about we've seen churches where they spray people with, you know, cleaning detergent, and they make them drink all sorts of animals and weird kinds of things, and saying that they're really concerned about that too. They also spoke about feminism and the femicide and the killing of women and children, that they're seriously concerned about this. But on the top of the agenda as well is including albino people in the group of vulnerable groups, saying that they are being used for certain traditional muti, and they need to be prioritized in the vulnerable groups as well. And also interestingly, Stephen, they also spoke about the decriminalization of sex work, which was apparently brought through by the Gauteng government, who then said, the Gauteng group, who were saying that it should be decriminalized, but apparently that did not go to, it did not go down too well. And they were also proposing that it shouldn't be women who were facing a crime here, but it should be the men who were seeking sex work who should actually face the crime.
So in other words, what they would do is that if someone had paid for sex, that's the person, the man who commits the crime, rather than the person who receives the money for sex.
Absolutely.
The idea of, I mean, there's been a comment about an increase in racial tension. Just unpack that. What is Lindiwe Sisulu saying there?
She's saying that it seems as though that social coercion, and they also spoke about that, you know, we've been talking a lot about radical economic transformation, and with the rise in its racial tensions, she says there's a new manifestation of racism. And I mean, I just asked in the briefing just before I stepped out if she could elaborate on examples of this new manifestation of racism, but she says that with this increase in racial tensions, there needs to be socio-economic radical transformation.
So she's with Cyril then.
Sounds like it.
EWN's Masa Kakana, thank you very much indeed. You're at the Midday Report, 13 minutes after 12.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Well, plenty of people, of course, have spent the week here at the conference, the ANC's National Policy Conference at NASREC. And one of the people who I've bumped into virtually every day is the political analyst Aubrey Machiki, and he's joined us in our studios now. Aubrey, good afternoon to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. There's the microphone. There we are. We've managed to switch it on. Aubrey, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Last night, we had that decision by the ANC Strategy and Tactics Commission. It said 9 out of the 11 commissions had rejected President Jacob Zuma's formulation of our economy as white monopoly capital. I think most people have seen that as a rejection of Zuma, or of course, as Anna Dlamini Zuma in some ways. Do you go along with that?
Well, what people are saying is that, contrary to expectations, Zuma does not have the numbers at this policy conference. I think that's an incorrect reading of what happened here. People must remember how the ANC has been changing, and that has been captured in what some of you have been saying, including the Secretary General, that qualitatively the ANC is in decline, including the quality of what it calls its cadres, which means that unfortunately for the Zuma faction, a lot of the people who support Zuma who are here may not be people who are interested in the policy discussion, and therefore were outgunned by the other side, because they were out-argued, because the other side is interested in the policy and ideological argument. And therefore, the disjuncture you have is that at a policy conference, you may win the argument, but lose the vote in December.
So you're making a big difference between the quality of argument and numbers. Your argument is that in the ANC of 2017 in December, it's all about numbers.
In December 2017, what is going to count are the numbers. So the problem I see with the other side, the CR17 side, is that they may speak in sophisticated conceptual terms, but may not be reaching the delegate, the ordinary delegate who will be in December, who will be at the conference in December. And what will matter is the fact that when it comes to the ballot box, people don't vote in English.
don't they... Isn't it true, though, that policy is also by numbers? In other words, you would expect KZN to go one way and Gauteng to go another. We're not quite seeing that. I mean, in a way, this whole race, again, as it always tends to do, comes down to KwaZulu-Natal. It seems hard to know exactly where that province is, except to say that it's not 100% unified behind anyone.
Well, there's another way of reading what happened here yesterday, that both sides can claim victory to the extent that you have one side that is invoking white monopoly capital dishonestly, and another side which has been denying its existence dishonestly. So they can both claim victory because the conference acknowledges the existence of white monopoly capital, but rejects the idea of using the term white monopoly capital. So both sides can take something out of this.
Shades of emphasis of politics about words. Who would have thought? It's a policy conference. It's supposed to be about policy. Has it been?
When you listen to the policy argument at this conference, you must remember that the policy argument has two dimensions. There's the policy argument itself, and then there's the proxy argument. And what has been happening here a lot, it seems, in my observation, is that the proxy argument has trumped the policy argument itself. So when people stand up in opposition to or in support of a particular policy option, they have at the same time been expressing their antipathy towards or support for a particular leader or support for a particular political preference.
What does how this conference has played out? I mean, for many people, I think one of the key moments of the year, and certainly for myself with my sort of my political hat on for a moment, one of the key moments of the year was always going to be the entrance of President Jacob Zuma and the Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa into this hall in front of ANC delegates for the first time this year. It was very muted. In fact, there was almost no reaction to the arrival of President Jacob Zuma at all. Then the next key moment perhaps comes when he makes the closing address, and again we see the same thing. It seems that the ANC has managed to keep most of its delegates very disciplined, or both sides just aren't ready yet.
Well, we saw the same thing in 2015 at the National General Council. But you did see some exuberance in support of Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. And there's been an attempt at gauging the balance of support by how loud each of the choirs have been.
It seems, though, I mean, when you look at that, the one person who hasn't spoken at this conference at all is Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma.
She doesn't have to. In fact, she reminds me of Ace Ntsweleng, who used to play for Kaizer Chiefs, who didn't do a lot of running, who let the ball do the running for him. And in the same way, she has the advantage of already enjoying the support of the dominant faction. On the other hand, you have Cyril Ramaphosa, who must create a new majority in the ANC. And actually, if anyone has to be more visible at this conference, it is him. Dlamini Zuma doesn't have to.
There's been a lot about that in Ramaphosa, and then there's been a lot of talk, I mean, a lot of it below the line, if you like, but there's been a lot of talk of Didi Mabuza, the Premier of Mpumalanga. There's been suggestions, rumours, whispers that perhaps he swapped sides, he's going towards Ramaphosa. Do you see it like that?
There are some expectations about politics and politicians I find strange. The idea, first of all, that just because you belong to the same faction, you are going to agree on everything, to me is bizarre. Secondly, you come to a national policy conference where almost every speaker has condemned factionalism. And Didi Mabuza declares that it does not belong to a faction, and you take that at face value. That too is bizarre.
Aubrey Machikli, thank you very much indeed. Political analyst on in our studio, almost said on the line to us, but of course in our studio here at NASREC. Thank you very much indeed. I really do appreciate the time. You're with the Midday Report, hoping to speak to Professor Stephen Friedman in a moment. He's on hold, I think, on the line from Johannesburg. We're hoping to speak to him in a moment or two about his views on that. 20 minutes after 12 now, the time, and he's ready for us. Professor Stephen Friedman, good afternoon to you. Thank you for your time today. I do really appreciate it. We've been hearing critique after critique at this policy conference about our society and about its economy. Have you heard many solutions to the problems that face us coming out of this conference?
No, good afternoon, Stephen. Not really. I'm not sure that this is about solutions at this stage. I think it's about positioning factions within the ANC. And I think as long as it's about that, we're going to hear a lot of stress on whether we should be talking about monopoly capital or white monopoly capital, and whether it's particular forms of radical transformation. But I don't think we're going to hear terribly much about what they're going to try to do to fix the problem.
In the end, economic policy, I've been saying this all week, economic policy is a hard thing to make. It's even harder if you define yourself as a multi-class movement.
Yeah, it is. And I think the other point that needs to be borne in mind, Stephen, is that we're, whatever is discussed at this conference, we're a lot long way from a policy. Besides the obvious point that this entire conference has been about discussing what will be discussed at the end of the year, so there are no resolutions. Even if resolutions are passed at the end of the year, those have to go through the government system. And nowhere in the world does a governing party's resolutions simply become government policy. So even if some of these decisions are taken in December, what happens after that is that you have a fairly lengthy process in which the relevant government departments have to check out what whether what they're doing is possible. They have to negotiate with various interest groups. So, you know, these debates are very interesting to get a sense of what the politics of the ANC is. But I think anybody who starts reading off this what is going to happen in the economy is being way too premature. A lot of steps would have to be gone through before any of this actually becomes concrete economic policy.
We keep hearing that the idea of policy as proxy for the leadership battle. I mean, I think it's probably unarguable now that that may be the case. Is it getting a bit harder to work out at this stage who might actually win? I mean, at one level, it seems President Zuma loses this. Aubrey Machiki thinks that we're being premature with that too. But do you think it's possible to get any kind of reading of the balance of power in the ANC? I mean, it is always slightly cloudy.
It is very cloudy at this stage. I mean, Stephen, if we compare this to 2007, which a lot of people have been doing, there it was very clear after the policy conference that the tide was moving towards Jacob Zuma and away from Thabo Mbeki. This is far less clear. In fact, what we seem to be having is a continuation of what we've been having for a long time now, which is trench warfare between these two factions. And quite frankly, you know, I think South Africans may have to start getting adjusted to the possibility that this great battle within the ANC that we've been watching for the last few months may not actually end in December at all, because we may have a situation that's being talked about more and more now, in which there will be some sort of fudge of the leadership race. So you won't have one faction winning and the other faction losing. You'll have some sort of compromise between the two. And then a lot of your policy statements will be the same sort of fudges as we've been seeing for the last couple of days. So, you know, I think the most interesting takeout from this conference is that it really has confirmed that we may be in a situation where what we land up with is a compromise within the ANC rather than a pure victory for anybody.
Professor Friedman, if I can ask you just to change hats for a moment, you're one of the academics who signed a letter calling for a proper debate on the role of the Reserve Bank and particularly its monetary policy mandate. And of course, this debate was sort of kick-started just in time for the policy conference, interestingly, by the public protector advocate Pusisiwe Mkhwebane and her finding in her report on the Absa Bank story, on the Absa Bank issue, that the mandate of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Reserve Bank should be changed. Why do you think it's important to have a proper debate on this issue?
Well, because, Stephen, you know, I think that the question of the role of the Reserve Bank is an important public issue in any democracy. It so happens that the mandate which our Reserve Bank has is quite narrow if you compare it to other central banks, to the American Federal Reserve, the Australian Central Bank, the European Central Bank. Even the Bank of England, to a certain extent, has wider mandates than our Reserve Bank does. So there's certainly room for debate about whether we would be better off with a wider mandate, which would enable the bank, of course, not simply to look at protecting the currency, but to look at what needs to be done to make employment a bit easier and to make growth a bit easier. But of course, the whole purpose of the statement is to say we desperately need this debate, but we certainly do not need this debate in the form in which the public protector has put it on the table. So at the one hand, you're trying to, as we are, make the point that South Africans ought to debate these issues. On the one hand, you're saying that for a public protector whose rulings are binding, to presume that she can decide what should appear in the Constitution and what should not, and that she as an individual should decide what the role of the bank should be and what it should not be, is entirely unacceptable, particularly since, as you imply, this is very convenient for a particular faction within the ANC. So what we're trying to do is separate off the question of a genuine debate about the Reserve Bank, in which South Africans who care about the economy and the society can debate freely what is best for the country, and attempt to undermine the Reserve Bank for factional reasons, which unfortunately seems to be what the Public Protector's report is about.
I mean, I could imagine the response to you might be that, yes, we accept there should be a debate about this, but when the ratings agencies are watching this so closely, the finance ministry has had a big change with the removal of Pravin Gordhan and the appointment of Melusi Gigaba. Now's just simply not the time, because it'll make ratings agencies more nervous than they already are. I mean, would you accept that maybe we should have the debate, but just not now?
No, I don't think it's when you have the debate. I think it's who has the debate. I mean, look, there's a whole debate to be had on rating agencies. But I think that rating agencies should be forced to account. If rating agencies feel that it's unacceptable for South African academics and people with a stake in the economy to discuss what our Reserve Bank should do, then they must explain to us why it's unacceptable for South Africans to do what everybody in every other democracy in the world does. If rating agencies are genuinely concerned about an attempt by the public protector to undermine the independence of the Reserve Bank for factional reasons, then they're absolutely right. So what we're trying to do with this statement is to say that it's not whether you have the discussion, it's how you have the discussion and what your motives are. And I think that any rating agency which is concerned about South Africans debating with honest intentions how their economy should be governed, I think that we would have to reject that, and hopefully the people who influence rating agencies would understand that that's what people in the democratic economy do.
Professor Stephen Friedman, thank you very much indeed. Political analyst on the line from Johannesburg.
The Midday Report. Business.
With Stephen Grotius.
The CWN Business is brought to you by FNB. It's more than just business to you. That's why they help. The rand's firmed slightly today as the ANC's policy conference is drawing to a close, while the US dollar has slipped on concerns about rising tensions between the US and North Korea. Analysts here say they believe the radical plans within the ANC for a complete overhaul of the economy have not gained traction, which they say will be positive for the rand. North Korea said yesterday it had conducted a test of a new intercontinental ballistic missile that could carry a large and heavy nuclear warhead. A member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee has said that the bank might be about to raise interest rates for the first time in a decade. Michael Saunders has said households in the UK should prepare for interest rates to go higher at some point. On the markets at the moment, the JSE All Share is up nearly 0.5% at 52,307 points. Resources up 0.69% at 31,552. Industrials up 0.78% at 70,939. Gold at the moment, $1,219.47 an ounce. Platinum, $904. Oil at the moment, $49.66 a barrel. And the currencies, the rand to the euro, 15.09 to the British pound, 17.20 to the American dollar, 13.33 at the moment. More, of course, on The Money Show tonight between 6 and 8 this evening.
The Midday Report. Stephen's on Twitter at Stephen Grotius.
Well, a couple of tweets coming through about the conversations we've been having. Katang Malafane says, what dominant faction is your guest talking about? Okay, Katang. King Spoo says the Reserve Bank's mandate debate may indeed be necessary, but it must be driven by Parliament, not any other institution. He's making a point there. Other tweets coming through. Lots of people still, of course, tweeting about David McClobbell this morning for some reason. Chinas in Kototlane says the ANC must stay away from the term white monopoly capital and use Gupta monopoly capital instead. And Mpahlele Kunene says, I think Mahlobo, David Mahlobo, must be charged for knowing about a potential crime and not acting to prevent it as the Minister of State Security. You can join the conversation. Tweet me at Stephen Grotus.
The Midday Report with Stephen Grotus.
24 minutes now to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon to you. You're at the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. Don't forget, of course, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can go to 702andcapetalk.co.za to listen back to any of the interviews that we've done on the program. Well, confirmation this morning, breaking news, in fact, that the headquarters of the Hawks in Silverton was robbed overnight. EWN's Mandy Wiener helped to break the story this morning. She's on the line from Joburg. Mandy, good afternoon to you. What actually happened?
Well, what we know is that there was a break-in at the headquarters of the Hawks in Silverton. It was in the early hours this morning or later last night. We know that the area that was targeted wasn't where the investigations are done. It's where the HR is and the support services. We know that computers were taken, but there is an investigation that's going on at this stage about what else was taken. It seems no dockets were stolen, but they're looking at whether any other kind of documentation may have been taken. So we don't know actually at the stage if anything's been compromised in any way.
It seems incredible. I mean, the Hawks are supposed to be an elite unit.
Yeah, I mean, it really is just unbelievable that an elite unit has been broken into the way that it has. From what we understand, there's no sign of a break-in, and access cards are required to actually gain access to this particular area of the offices. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, it does look as though it was some kind of an inside job. The Hawks are not saying that at this stage, but if there's no sign of a break-in and you need an access card to get in, it's highly likely that it was some kind of an inside job. But they are saying that they will be assessing security to see just whether or not it's up to scratch or not.
Mandy, it's not the first robbery we've had. I mean, I think at one point even the headquarters of the State Security Agency was robbed of foreign cash. We had, of course, that robbery on the office of the Chief Justice as well. And again, in that was also computers.
Well, yes, that's right. So when that robbery at the Chief Justice's office happened in March this year, then Acting National Commissioner Khumoto Phakalane came out and said that it was computers that were stolen again from the HR department, and that some private information of some judges may have been compromised. Again, it's the HR department. Again, it's computers that have been stolen. And by coincidence, today, two people accused of that burglary are actually appearing in court for that particular crime. So, you know, there are parallels being drawn between the two incidents. This keeps happening at government departments, and particularly government departments that shouldn't be compromised in this way. You know, I mean, the fact that the Hawks are the elite crime-fighting unit and their own offices have been broken into, whether it is an inside job or not, really does raise some serious questions about just how these buildings are being secured and just how safe the information is in these buildings.
EWN's Mandy Wiener on that story. Thank you very much indeed.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
18 minutes to 1 o'clock at afternoon to you with the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. Don't forget, of course, that we'll have more from the ANC's National Policy Conference here from Nasrec, the Eyewitness News team reporting back on the commissions. I understand at the moment that, in fact, the Economic Transformation Commission, this is, I suppose, the most controversial and interesting and perhaps important commission, is reporting back to the plenary at the moment. When we get details of that, of course, we'll bring them to you. You'll be able to go to ewn.co.za as well and check out the latest on that. There's been a lot of attention over the last few days to a claim by the man who calls himself Prophet Mboro. He said that he had been to hell and he had slain Satan. Pastor Mboro is someone who's been around in local communities in Joburg for some years. Denise Ackerman is a theologian on the line from
Hello.
Cape Town. Denise, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Someone like Pastor Mboro, Prophet Mboro, to use the title he gives himself, he makes outrageous claims. Why do so many people like him do that? Do they really expect to be believed?
I think they do, and I think the reason that they do is because they understand how much there is success if you play on people's fears and their hopes. And many of these self-instituted churches come out of situations where people have deep-seated needs, and so people like that exploit it. And I'm afraid if you really follow the trail of the money, you'll see that how religion can be a very lucrative business. And that's the part of it that I find deeply offensive.
I mean, we're talking about someone who spent, or helped to spend with a consortium, 5 million rand on a pigeon last year. it doesn't seem as if he spreads the wealth.
No, of course he doesn't spread the wealth if that is what he did. I don't know the facts. But what I can say is that that is certainly completely alien to the teachings of the man that he purports to follow. Jesus Christ was somebody who didn't own property, didn't extort money from people. I mean, it is just preposterous when religion and people's fears come together. It's extremely lucrative, as I've said.
Is there much that government can do here?
Well, government was proposing to do something. I remember you asking me about that before, and I laughed because I don't think that government has ever managed to control people's religious impulses and the use of religion throughout the history of religions. But I do think that perhaps the tax man should have a look at his tax returns. I don't know how you deal with this sort of thing. But it is really awfully, awfully sad because it's taking so many people for a religious ride.
I mean, one of the examples, just talking to you now, that pops into my head immediately is the pastor T.B. Joshua in Nigeria. And, of course, we had that awful collapse of the building. And one of the things was that it was very difficult for the emergency services to simply get on the property. Some of these people amass incredible power.
Yes, they do amass a lot of power because they have power over people. That's the wrong kind of power. Power should not be over others in the sense that you can just use them for your own aims. Instead of empowering them to deal with the hardships of their lives, I suppose they do empower them if these poor people believe all the promises that are made to them. But I have yet to see these promises having any validity other than to make people come together in situations where there is awful need.
Are there maybe a few?
There's a failure of the institutional churches. I mean, these self-instituted churches pop up all over because people are looking for this sort of thing. And one might well ask, where are the usual churches? Whatever you want to call them, the mainline churches. Well, why are they not there helping people? I suppose because they can't make these exorbitant promises.
Are there maybe a few tests you can develop for, and I mean, I can realize the philosophical idiocy of what I'm about to say, but are there a few tests you can develop for what is a real church and what isn't a real church? I mean, could you maybe look and say, how much is done for charity by the church? What are the messages of the church? I mean, I know people call it a sort of affluent religion almost, that you need to look rich. I mean, certainly all the pastors that I see in this market look rich. Is that a warning sign? But then I imagine people could say, well, certain people in the Catholic Church look pretty rich as well.
Undoubtedly they do. You only have to go to the Vatican to see how rich it is. I'm not very good on this because I'm afraid I belong to a church that I'm told is broke. So maybe that's the real sign of a proper church. But I think that what you need to look at is what is the use of people's... how are people used as a resource in the church? How much money is exacted from them? Are people giving willingly and gladly and having that money used for good causes? That I don't know. I mean, there are many tests you can make. For me, I'd have to talk theology if I had to answer that question properly, and you don't want me to do that.
Denise Ackerman, thank you very much indeed. I'm sure we'll discuss theology and philosophy at some point in the future. Denise Ackerman is a theologian on the line there from Cape Town. 13 minutes to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon to you with the Midday Report. I should just point out on Twitter that Floyd and Kuhner has got in touch saying that yesterday Pastor Mboro said his Facebook account was hacked and he never went to kill Lucifer. He's furious and he's got the laughing out loud sign, the emoji with the laughing and the crying all at the same time. Floyd and Kuhner tweeting me there on that one. The government of Qatar has now finally formally responded to a list of demands placed upon it by four Arab nations who are threatening to blockade the country, claiming that it has been sponsoring terrorism. EWN's Paula Sleer on the line now from Tel Aviv. Paula, good day to you. What response is Qatar giving?
Hi. Well, currently underway in Cairo is a meeting by the foreign ministers and intelligence officers of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. Now, those are the countries that imposed a boycott on Qatar some 1 month ago, and they gave Qatar a list of 13 demands that it had to meet by Monday, none of those demands, or in fact, there wasn't a response from Qatar on Monday, so that was extended until today, another 48 hours. And the latest information we have is that the Qataris have handed over their response via Kuwait, who is acting as a mediator in this whole standoff. But we don't know yet how many, if any, of the demands that have been put forward to Qatar are being agreed upon. Previously, Qatar did say that some of the demands simply can't be met and that the country was being set up for failure.
This is really something we haven't seen before. Qatar is a nation state. It has, as the international lawyers would say, sovereignty. And yet the demands from these countries are quite extreme.
It certainly is something we haven't seen before. It just points to what is happening across the Middle East. There are many countries that are facing this kind of standoff, and a lot of the standoff is really between Saudi Arabia, which is spearheading this whole anti-Qatari feeling, and Iran, which is on the side of Qatar. If you look at some of these demands, one of the demands is for Qatar to reduce diplomatic ties with Iran. So you have Saudi Arabia and Iran, kind of the two regional powers standing off against each other, and Qatar, many are saying, is becoming a pawn in that. What is problematic is that the United States has a large military base in Qatar. So on the one hand, the United States is making overtures to move closer to Iran, but on the other hand, now you have Saudi Arabia, which the United States also has relationships with and close relationships, saying, well, we don't want to have anything to do with Qatar. So it starts becoming a little bit messy in terms of all the alliances that exist in the Middle East. Another demand is also closing Al Jazeera network. Now, I've been talking to some of my colleagues at the network, and of course, they're very concerned about that. The criticism against Al Jazeera from the Saudis is that it incites terrorism. But essentially, what journalists are saying, well, what does that mean for freedom of press? And what? How can you prove an incitement of terrorism? So there's a lot of questions and a lot of concern over these developments.
In the end, I mean, Russia and the United States both heavily invested in the region. There's Syria just in the background, of course. I would imagine the United States in particular, strong relationship with Saudi Arabia, military base in Qatar, it's not enjoying this at all.
Look, it's really difficult to say what's going on in the United States. One of the demands, as far as I understand it, is that the United States and European countries will monitor what the Qatari responses. So if Qatar agrees to some of these demands, it will be their responsibility to make sure that that happens. But the reason why I say the U.S. is a bit confusing is because you had the American President Donald Trump on his first overseas visit going to Saudi Arabia and signing this huge $1 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia, and then coming back, and then the Saudis announced that they're cutting ties with Qatar, which is also an ally of the United States. And then you had Trump saying what he's happy to hear, that the Saudis are taking the message of fighting terrorism strongly. But is that message of fighting terrorism strongly a correct message if you're cutting off ties with another American ally, which is Qatar? So it does get very messy, and there have been conflicting statements coming out of the United States. It's not so clear-cut that they definitely support the Saudis in this. Yes, the United States is against terrorism, but who defines who are the terrorists when it comes to the whole Middle East playing ground?
If Qatar refuses to agree to these conditions, how do you see it playing out? I mean, it's a very small nation. It has, I think, just one border. It's in a very difficult position.
It certainly is in a very difficult position. And let me bring another country into the whole four. You have Turkey. One of the demands being placed on the Qataris is to hold the Turkish military base in Qatar. Now, the Turks have got involved and said, well, there's no way you can put demands on us in terms of what we do in Qatar. So, again, it's not just an issue between the Saudis and the Qataris. As you mentioned, the United States is part of it. We see the Turks are part of it. It's not clear at this stage. A, whether or not the Qataris will accede to these demands, and B, what will happen if they don't. I mean, you would imagine that there would be some kind of repercussions, and any kind of repercussions is only going to flare up the situation even more. Certainly the sense we're getting monitoring the situation is that the Qataris have no intention to stand by all of these demands. Maybe they'll meet some of them, but certainly not all of them. As I mentioned to you earlier, they say that some of them they simply cannot be met. It's as if they're being set up for failure. So, of course, that begs the question, well, then what are we going to see? Saudis, and it's not just the Saudis. As I mentioned, it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, it's Yemen, it's Maldives. There's a whole host of Sunni countries that have become part of this boycott of Qatar.
EWN's Paul Astier on the line from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much indeed.
The Midday Report. Stephen's on Twitter at Stephen Hortus.
Just going 5 minutes to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. Just in the big briefing hall behind me, Jackson Mtembu, the chair of the ANC's Communications Commission, is giving a briefing. I understand that Zizi Kodwa, the national spokesperson for the ANC, is actually wearing a black armband in solidarity with journalists amid all of the reports that we've heard lately of intimidation recently. But a couple of points coming from Jackson Mtembu. This is from EWN reporter Mtembu, saying that free-to-air television must live and get premium content. It must not play a second role to pay television, and that we can't wait to migrate in 2018 for the digital migration process of terrestrial television. It must actually start to happen now. He's also said that the print media plays an important role, but being held accountable is important. And does there need to be another mechanism to hold the print media accountable? There'll be more from that, of course, in the EWN bulletins. A big discussion over the last few days about the role that testosterone plays in the effectiveness of female athletes, with a new study suggesting that the higher the levels of testosterone, the better the performance of a female athlete will actually be. Ross Tucker is a sports scientist. He's on the line now from Luxembourg. Ross, good day to you there. How important, in your view, is testosterone for female athletes?
Well, hi, Stephen. I think testosterone is the fundamental difference between men and women, and so it's not a coincidence that since the 1960s, most doping has been involved the use of testosterone. So I think it's absolutely critical. Whether it is possible to say that the difference within a group of female athletes is testosterone, that's a subtly different question on which the Court of Arbitration decision hinged 2 years ago and probably will again soon.
Is this, I mean, we seem to be learning more and more about the importance of this. Does this mean that we're likely to have different views over the next decade or so as we learn more?
Yes, probably. There's going to be some dispute, and even this new study, which you've alluded to from the IAAF, came out on Monday, is going to divide opinion, because what they found is that in five events, female athletes who have higher testosterone levels are significantly better performers than the athletes who have low testosterone. So people will point to that and say, well, that's proof that testosterone gives female athletes a significant advantage. The problem is that there are 15 events where that difference was not significant. And so depending on which side of the divide you stand, you will point to it and say it either proves testosterone's benefit or it actually proves that there is no benefit. So while we're learning, we're also creating more and more complexity in which there is space to disagree.
I seem to remember reading somewhere that if you go back to the records in women's athletics, you will see that a whole lot of records were broken during the sort of doping scandals of the East Germans, and I think some of the Russians were involved in the 1980s. When that doping stopped, all of the record breaking stopped as well. They haven't actually moved nearly as much as the men's have over the last three decades.
Some of them, Stephen, have barely budged. If you look at the women's world records for track and field events that involve significant power and speed, so we're talking sprint events and then the throwing events, those records date back almost without exception to the 1980s. And in fact, there's a moment in history in 1987, which is when out-of-competition drug testing was introduced. And since that point in time, not a single women's field event record has been broken. And so women's world records are basically fossilized because of the effect of testosterone. It was that powerful a drug that even 30 years, plus all the other innovations, have not yet managed to help women athletes reach the level of performance that testosterone did in the 1980s.
At the moment, we have athletic events divided. I mean, the big dividing line is male events and female events. I have to wonder if that's not a little artificial.
It is artificial. It was done, I guess, because it seemed simple at the time. The problem we've got now, when we recognize this category of athletes, or people, in fact, who are called intersex, and that they don't fall into one of those neat, convenient binary categories, is that there simply aren't enough of them to enable us to have more than two categories. So people have argued that we should have an intersex category of competition. But the problem is that those conditions are so rare that there would be literally only a handful of athletes who would want to compete there. So it's not a viable solution to try and effectively cut the pie up into more pieces. So at the moment, we're stuck with this male-female and division, and that's what creates the controversies around athletes like Semenya, because they don't fit neatly into one of those binary categories.
Look, Caster Semenya, I mean, one of the most popular athletes in South Africa, I think because she's faced so many difficulties and borne them in the way that she has. It would be devastating, I think, for her and for the nation if any of this were to affect her. Do you think it will?
Stephen, I don't think it will. I've looked at that evidence now that the IAAF have got. Again, I don't know how the court will rule on it towards the end of this month, but my feeling is that the IAAF have gone some of the way to providing evidence for testosterone, because 2 years ago, that's what the court said was required. They said that there was insufficient evidence that testosterone was a significant performance advantage for athletes with these conditions. The IAAF have gone some of the way to providing that evidence, but I don't think that they've done enough. And I think that the advantage that they've found, which is between 2 and 5%, is not large enough for the court to overturn that decision. I may yet be proven incorrect, but I think that because of the way that the court ruled in the first instance 2 years ago, they set pretty clear requirements for what would be required. And I don't think that this evidence will actually clear that bar, and I suspect that the status quo will remain. But we'll only know that towards the end of this month.
Ross Tucker on the line from Luxembourg, a sports scientist. Really do appreciate it. That's it for the Midday Report. Do stay with us. There'll be more, of course, from the Economic Transformation Commission when it reports back. It's just 2 seconds after 1 o'clock.